I'm Brian Lehrer. This is my Daily Politics Podcast from WNYC Studios. It's Monday, November 8th. As the COP26 climate summit is now in its second and final week, we'll get a very informed view of how it's going now, but also take a step back. Think about this. What is the relationship between global warming in the atmosphere and the effect on human beings? Well, one very basic answer to that question is that it changes where on Earth is habitable or uninhabitable, right? If you could live in a place along the ocean before, but sea level rise is making that place uninhabitable now, people have to move. If a country in the global south was hot and dry but was cool enough and had enough moisture for agriculture, and now it's not, people have to move. So climate change causes migration, more migration than there would have been without it. It also can cause armed conflict, war, where large enough groups of desperate enough people have to compete or move for food. And when any of these developments affect large populations of poor people, the result is many refugees, climate refugees. It's already happening to a tragic degree and will only get worse if meetings like COP26 fail to prevent it. So with me now is David Miliband, president and CEO of the International Rescue Committee, which helps to resettle and advocate for the world's refugees. And as some of you know, he was previously the foreign minister of the UK, so he knows many of these government leaders at COP26 and knows how these things work and don't. David, it's always great and important when you come on the show. Welcome back to WNYC.
Thank you so much, Brian, for having me on. And you've basically said it all. You've said in 45 seconds what we're going to cover in half an hour. But it's great to be talking to you. I look forward to exploring the issues.
So you agree with the premise of my intro that climate change is already causing an increase in the number of the world's refugees. It may not be the first thing that many people who listen to radio shows like this in the United States think of. So let's look at a few of the specific places and populations to which this is happening. Your website mentions one, for example, much in the news in the United States, but for other reasons, migration to here from the Central American countries of El Salvador, Guatemala, and Honduras. Can you explain what that has to do with climate change?
Yeah. The critical thing for people to understand is that there are direct and indirect effects of the climate crisis on the forced movement of people. The direct impact is precisely as you suggested, that if some places become too hot, if some places become water-stressed, they can lead to people to move. Critical to understanding is to remember that the climate crisis isn't just about the average rise in the global temperature that can have an impact on sea levels or other things. It's also a change in the climate that causes more extreme weather events. And in respect of Central America, we're seeing a lot of extreme weather events that are contributing to the movement of people. Often those people stay within their own country. They're climate refugees within their own country, but they also cross borders and move further. The indirect effect is also worth recognizing, and we'll come back to this in the course of the conversation. You mentioned rightly that because the climate crisis puts more stress on resources, when there's stress on resources, there's more conflict. When there's conflict, people move. And just to put an interesting statistic in your head, of the 20 countries in the world most vulnerable to climate change, 14 of them are already suffering from armed conflict.
Wow.
And so we can see the indirect effect as well as the direct effect. And in the so-called Northern Triangle of Guatemala, Honduras, and El Salvador, you're seeing some of the direct effects. They've got other problems as well, which we can get into. But whether you look at Northern Central America with its extreme weather events, whether you look at the origins of the Syria crisis, which had a climate dimension in the drought in the northwest of the country in 2008 to 2010, whether you think about the trauma of Afghans at the moment, who are suffering from a meltdown in their economy after the withdrawal of American troops, there's a climate effect there because 90% of the rural areas have been suffering from drought, and so they've missed the planting season. Or whether you think about the Sahel region of sub-Saharan Africa, I was on a call this morning with some colleagues in Mali. There are complicated factors at work there. But in answer to your question, climate change, the climate crisis, is here now. It's leading to the forced displacement of people. And it's imperative, therefore, that this climate conference, this UN climate conference in Glasgow, all the nations of the world, get serious about mitigating future climate change, preventing it by changing the way in which we power our economies. But they also get serious about helping communities adapt to climate change. Because if there isn't better adaptation, then people will be on the move in ever greater numbers.
Let's take another example, another place much in the news in this country, but for different reasons, Afghanistan, which your IRC website says is in a worsening humanitarian crisis exacerbated by drought. Can you give us some of the details of that and how it connects to climate change?
Yes. We said in August, when American military forces left, that it would be a disaster if the military withdrawal was followed by a humanitarian and economic withdrawal. But unfortunately, that's what's happened. I'm going to give you some absolutely staggering statistics, and they are exacerbated by the climate crisis, Brian. The World Food Programme is forecasting that 55%, more than half of the Afghan population, the population that remains is about 38 million people. 70,000 Afghans came out and have come to the United States in the midst of the crisis of August, but 38 million are left. More than half of that population are placed in the highest levels of food insecurity. That means they don't know where their next meal is coming from. And part of that reason is that the salaries of teachers and nurses are not being paid because there's a freeze on international support for the country because of the Taliban regime that's come in. But part of the reason, so those people can't buy food. But large parts of Afghanistan are rural, where they run what's called a subsistence economy. That means people grow their own food and survive on the basis of it. Drought is affecting, as I said earlier, about 90% of 80 to 90% of the Afghan population. And so the food production system in rural areas has broken down as well. It's a further example of the way in which the climate crisis doesn't just impact livelihoods, it drives people to move. Part of Afghanistan's story in the last 20 years has been urbanization, in part driven by the climate crisis. Mm-hmm. And I think there's been a real failure over the last 30 or 40 years. We talk about the climate crisis as if it affects the planet, quote unquote, but it affects the people on the planet as well as the planet itself, living as if there are three planets, not one, which is I'm 56, God help me, sorry to admit that, but we've lived as if there were three planets, not one. And if you do that, it affects the people on the planet. This is a man-made displacement crisis, and I'm afraid it's also a poverty crisis and a health crisis in various ways as well. And there is still time to make a difference, but we've got to deal with the fact that the greenhouse gases that have been put into the atmosphere are going to be there, in many cases, for 80 to 100 years. It's true that methane, about which there was an agreement led by President Biden last week to cut by 30% the methane emissions, methane only stays in the atmosphere for 20 years. That's bad enough because it's eight times as potent as carbon dioxide. But for the other greenhouse gases, like carbon dioxide, that come out of our travel systems, out of the burning of coal, that's in the atmosphere for 100 years. And so we've baked into the planetary system impact on humans. And it's deeply short-sighted, to put it mildly, not to recognize that. So we've got catch-up to do, and we've got adaptation to do.
So, David, I see we have some callers coming in who will take in a couple of minutes connected to various countries around the world to tell this human, and I love the way you put that, this is discussed much too much as save the planet and not enough in terms of people when we talk about the impacts of climate change, global warming. So turning to COP26, and I'll remind everyone that COP stands for Conference of the Parties to the Paris Climate Accord, and it's COP26 because this is their 26th meeting, the countries that signed the Paris Climate Accords. So how's it going, in your view, to make the commitments necessary to accomplish their goal of preventing warming greater than 1.5 Celsius degrees or 2.7 degrees Fahrenheit, after which it's believed that the even more drastic and extreme effects of global warming would take effect.
Yeah, this is the 26th meeting since the UN started summoning these climate conferences of all countries in 1994-5. They missed a year last year. These are the conference of the parties to the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change, which said that this is a global problem that needs to be addressed by every country according to its wealth and to its historic.
So that's, I just want to make that clear, because I think I misstated it last week then too. This is not conference of the parties to the Paris Climate Accord. It's the parties to something much bigger and older.
Yes, the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change, which was the first time in the mid-1990s that all the countries of the United Nations recognized that climate change was an issue. That led in 1997 to the Kyoto Protocol, which bound rich countries to reduce their emissions. The US government at the time signed it, but then the Senate didn't pass it. And then subsequently, there have been further conferences. The Paris conference in 2014 was a landmark conference because it had tougher targets than before, and it bound every country to submit a plan for how it would help the world live within a substantially less than 2 degrees rise in average warming. That's been interpreted as a 1.5 degrees rise. So it's a UN Framework Convention on Climate Change, UNFCCC. The Paris Agreement was within that framework. Now, the Glasgow meeting is important because although the Conference of the Parties happens every year, it is led at ministerial or prime ministerial or presidential level every 5 years. And, or 6 years because of COVID was lost last year, but effectively every 5 years. Mm-hmm. And so it's a landmark, it needs to be a landmark motion moment because we're off track to live within the limits established by Paris. And I would say that after a week of this Glasgow conference, we can only say that the glass is a quarter full. We do not yet have a global plan that will allow us all, and I say us, not just the planet, us all, to live within the 1.5 degrees limit that itself will be damaging but won't be catastrophic. There was progress last week on methane, which is a very dangerous greenhouse gas. There was progress on forestry because deforestation is so dangerous. Brazil, for the first time, because important because of the Amazon rainforest, was part of the agreement, although there are many people having doubts about the extent to which they will implement it. There was progress last week also about the pledges that were made by a range of countries that hadn't previously made pledges. So, for example, India made a pledge to get half of its energy from renewable energy by 2030. India has the largest population in the world, 1.4 billion people. However, it only committed to reach net zero emissions. You'll have heard this phrase net zero a lot. It means that the net impact of the country's emissions is zero because they are compensating for any greenhouse gas emissions they do. He's put that out till 2070. Now, I'll be 105 in 2070, and the world hasn't got that long to wait. And obviously, China and Russia have not turned up at this conference. There are spoilers. The UN process works. Every country has a veto, which means that countries like Saudi Arabia that are very dependent on the oil industry can veto any progress. And so it's really, we're up against it now. The glass is a quarter full because there are major commitments that still have to be made if we're to sustain the chance of limiting the average rise to 1.5 degrees. And I just want to emphasize, an average rise of 1.5 degrees shouldn't lull us into a false sense of security, because there's nothing average about the rise in extreme weather events that go along with this extraordinarily short-term impact, 150-year impact on the global climate that the route to industrialization based on carbon that we've chosen has had.
Jude in Brooklyn with ties to Nigeria. Jude, you're on WNYC. Thank you so much for calling in.
Yeah, good morning, Brian. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. I was just trying to say that the people from the south-south part of Nigeria, the remote communities where the oil is being explored, they have been facing pollution on their land and water. So at some point, they could no longer farm on their land. And then recently, the spill affected their water. So they could no longer also farm on, as they could no longer do fish farming. And some of them came up with cancer, you know, so they had to relocate some of them from their ancestral land. and the government awarded a contract for cleanup, but it seems the cleanup project is not achieving the desired result, though. So,
yes, and so there's yet another connection to global warming, even if what you were just describing isn't from the warming of the temperature of the atmosphere directly. It's from the drilling for the oil that, of course, contributes to the global warming and the effects of that. I think that's what I hear you saying, Jude, correct?
Yes, sir. Yes, and then they always have, Nigeria has been having incessant flooding these days. That has not been happening before. So you see people having to move from their place. Once they forecast that the flood is going to be immense, you know, it happens yearly now, and we never used to have that kind of situation before.
Jude, thank you very much. Yeah, and that would be more a direct consequence of global warming. Is Nigeria one of the countries you're focused on at the International Rescue Committee, David?
Yes, thanks to Jude for his important point. I mean, Nigeria raises a really important point. It's going to be the largest population in Africa, 206 million people at the moment, probably going to grow significantly in the next 30 years. It needs to industrialize to serve its own people. Its wealth comes significantly from oil and gas, but its oil, its production is part of a global system that is condemning large numbers of people in the north of the country to a really, really difficult existence. Now, I don't want to oversimplify this because the north-south split in Nigeria is religious, it's ethnic, it's not just about climate. But I think it's really important that we recognize that there is a climate reality and there's also a development or energy reality that needs to be addressed. The International Rescue Committee does work in northeast Nigeria. I've been myself to Maiduguri in the northeast of the country on two occasions. And you've mentioned a couple of times, Brian, the International Rescue Committee's website. I hope you don't mind me pointing people towards it. It's rescue.org, mm-hmm. where people can learn about the work that we're doing in northeast Nigeria and the way in which the climate crisis is contributing to humanitarian crisis. And my point always is, number one, this planetary crisis is a human crisis, as I said earlier. But secondly, untended humanitarian crisis ends up causing political instability. To go back to the countries that you mentioned at the beginning in the northern triangle of Central America, El Salvador, Guatemala, and Honduras, untended humanitarian crisis in those countries leads to political instability in those countries, and it doesn't stay within those countries because people move. Mm-hmm. And unless we address these issues as a shared humanity, we're not going to address them at all, and we're all going to suffer as a result.
Yes, I read about something called the heat-aggression relationship, which, according to the website ReliefWeb, suggests there is a 10 to 20% increase in the risk of armed conflict associated with each half a degree Celsius, or a little less than 1 degree Fahrenheit, increase in local temperatures. So I don't know.
Well, that's very striking. And at some level, it stands to reason. You know, if you think about parts of the world that are water stressed, I mean, that is what drives people to conflict. The conflict over resources is not just a theoretical point. When the Lake Chad Basin, that's the lake in between Nigeria, Cameroon, Niger, right in the corner there between all those countries, if any of your listeners click onto Lake Chad 30, a picture of Lake Chad 30 years ago and a picture of Lake Chad today, it's decimated. It's one third the size. And the idea that that doesn't have an impact on the fishermen who were fishing in Lake Chad and now cannot do so, and on the wider movement of people, they're kidding themselves. There is a major armed conflict in that part of the world. It's led by an armed opposition group that you have heard of, Boko Haram. And climate is part of the equation, not least in respect of the impoverishment that people feel there.
To close, I want to ask you if this COP26 meeting, which will continue until Friday, or this whole UN Conference of the Parties process that's been going on for a few decades now, as you were describing, is sufficient to the task. Because while COP26 meetings are taking place inside, there are thousands of mostly young protesters outside. And I want to play two clips of the 18-year-old protest leader, Greta Thunberg. In this one, she judges COP26 already a failure.
It is not a secret that COP26 is a failure. It should be obvious that we cannot solve a crisis with the same methods that got us into it in the first place.
And in this one, she explains how people of the world might be snowed into thinking that COP26 participants are doing more than they really are.
The COP has turned into a PR event where leaders are giving beautiful speeches and announcing fancy commitments and targets, while behind the curtains, the governments of the global north countries are still refusing to take any drastic climate action.
Greta Thunberg, to the crowd of protesters this weekend, how much do you agree, and ultimately, and this is my last question for you today, is the COP26 process, or this whole process as it's set up with, as she says, the same people who got us into this mess sort of pretending to get us out of it, up to the task?
Well, the science doesn't lie. So she's right. The pledges that have been made have not yet been followed through. And that's why it's so important that countries take their own decisions to set out on a net zero path as far as possible. The whole of the European Union, that's 27 countries, now have a decarbonization path that isn't just good for the planet and its people. Here's the point that I want to leave you with, especially to a predominantly American audience. The countries that make the biggest moves towards decarbonization, living as if there's one planet, not three, will reap the economic dividends as well as the environmental dividends being beneficial to the whole world. The fact that the Chinese are now dominating the solar panel market and have driven with massive reductions in the cost, they're in the front seat because they moved early. And I think it's a really important moment to say that the self-interest as well as the moral interest points in the direction of rapid movement. And America is an outlier here. In Europe, they're not arguing about whether or not climate change exists. In China, they're not arguing about whether climate change exists. In China, they need to do more, but they're figuring out how to get with this issue. And you have, per capita, the largest economy in the world by GDP. You have a massive opportunity, never mind a responsibility. And I'm a Brit, obviously, living in America. I live in New York. There's all sorts of things about this country that are amazing. But getting to grips with this climate crisis is not a diversion from America's problems. It's absolutely core to solving the economic challenges that you face. And I think that the words of Greta Thunberg are fundamentally right. Leadership, in the end, is tested by whether or not we're willing to take the decisions that shift the science. Because the science doesn't lie. The science can't spin. The science isn't about headlines. It's about people's lives. And it's people's lives close to home, but also people's lives far away. And I really hope that America's passion and ingenuity can be directed towards making a much bigger difference than has been made so far, because we can't afford more lost decades.
David Miliband, president of the International Rescue Committee and former UK foreign minister, thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Brian Lehrer, a Daily Politics podcast, is an excerpt from my live daily radio show, The Brian Lehrer Show, on WNYC Radio, 10 a.m. to noon Eastern Time, if you want to listen live at WNYC.org. Thanks for listening today. Talk to you next time.